The time is 9:45 a.m. The next item on our agenda is 2007-2008, number 84. This is before us on a motion for rehearing. And I'd first like to hear from someone on behalf of the motion for rehearing. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. I'm Stephen Lenhart, attorney for the movements. The main issue that we have with the title is the single subject question. The proposed initiative is a constitutional amendment that contains multiple subjects. Number one, requiring specified water supply considerations and local permitting for new housing. And number two, mandating fulfillment of water priorities for agricultural irrigation use. A court has held that when an initiative sets up implementation procedures, those procedures must have a necessary and proper relationship to the substance of the initiative in order to satisfy the single subject requirement. That's a case I believe we cited in our motion. The title board needs to examine the central theme of the initiative in order to determine whether it contains hidden purposes or incongruous measures under a broad theme, as the court held in the Gonzalez-Este case 2 years ago. The central theme of this initiative is to establish constitutional criteria for water supply and local permitting decisions for housing growth, and to assure that the water supply for such growth is, quote, sufficient and sustainable. In this regard, most of the initiative closely tracks a bill that was introduced in the legislature this year, House Bill 1141, in the form that it was originally introduced. However, the bill was later substantially amended in working its way through both houses. But the most substantial change that is made in Initiative 84 from the original House Bill 1141 is an additional provision, Section 3C3 of the initiative, that's incongruous with these provisions on water supply for housing growth. Section 3C3 requires that the state engineer provide a letter to the local government in which the state engineer letter not only determining if irrigation water priorities for agricultural purposes are reasonably fulfilled, but also, quote, requiring such. This provision requires the state engineer to issue both a finding and a mandate on a subject unrelated to the water supply for the development. Under the Colorado Constitution, Article 16, Sections 5 and 6, the reliability of water supplies is determined by priority of appropriation. Water supply shortages happen every year, at least part of the year, in virtually all of eastern Colorado and many parts of western Colorado. When water supplies are short, the more senior priorities have the better rights, and the more junior priorities, whether for agricultural irrigation or for municipal or domestic or for other uses, those more junior priorities go unfulfilled. Alongside the prior appropriation doctrine, Article 16, Section 6 of the Constitution also provides that those using water for domestic purposes shall have preference over those using it for agricultural purposes. In requiring fulfillment of agricultural water priorities as a precondition for extending domestic water use to new development, this measure would reverse the existing constitutional preference. It would also overturn established water right priorities by preferring junior agricultural rights over senior water rights that are required for development. Local water suppliers typically provide water for residential growth by acquiring senior water rights, often by purchasing those rights from agricultural users, or by developing a water storage reservoir. Either way, the result is that agricultural water rights are not fulfilled any less often or any more often as a result of the municipal growth. Thus, the provision in the measure for the state engineer to determine and require fulfillment of agricultural water rights has no necessary or proper connection to the provision for assuring sufficient and sustainable water supply for residential growth. This provision on fulfillment of agricultural priorities is coiled in the folds of the initiative, apparently with the aim of stopping residential growth by demanding a level of protection for agricultural water use rights that such rights have never before had. The court held in its 1995 decision, Public Rights in Waters II, that creation of a public trust standard for water rights cannot be combined with district election requirements in an initiative without violating the single subject requirement. Similarly, just last year on Initiative 17, the court held that creation of a public trust standard for state agency decisions can't be combined into an initiative restructuring those state agencies into a new department. Here, the same principle applies. It would violate the single subject requirement bold creation of a new preference for agricultural water rights into an initiative setting procedures for local approval of residential development.
Let's see if there's questions. And I guess I'd like, there's a couple of questions that I have, or a couple of avenues, I guess. I mean, first I want to try to understand the language of the measure. Because I think the interpretation that you give that section 3C3 I'm wondering about, and so maybe that's the first thing I need to ask about. I mean, I think the gist of it is the argument that this is a separate subject is based on the idea that this changes the priorities of existing water law. It elevates agricultural uses above residential. Is that a fair statement? Am I in the ballpark?
That's that is what we believe it means, and that's the only interpretation that I've been able to discern for this language.
Well, and let me try out another one, but maybe you can easily knock it down. Maybe I wasn't thinking this through. I mean, the measure is requiring a letter from the state engineer determining if irrigation water priorities for agricultural purposes are reasonably fulfilled. And requiring such, and the title. I mean, it's kind of a cumbersome wording, but the title, I think, kind of rephrased that to say requiring a determination from the state engineer that irrigation water priorities for agricultural purposes are reasonably fulfilled, and that's what seems subject to interpretation. I think I think your interpretation is reasonably fulfilled means. That they with reference to priorities means that they must have a higher priority than current law provides, but I wondered if it simply means very little, that it simply means just to make sure that the existing priorities are maintained for the protection of agricultural uses, but not actually changing the priorities. And I'm just wondering. I don't remember focusing on this on our initial hearing, with respect to at this level. So I'm just trying to figure out what does this mean, and is it susceptible to another interpretation?
We already have a water court system to ensure that when water rights change in use or when new water rights are obtained. And do not interfere with the exercise of any existing priorities for agricultural or other uses. And, it seems to me that this is requiring that requiring the state engineer to not only determine if, but also require that irrigation water priorities for agricultural purposes are reasonably fulfilled.
I mean, go ahead, Mr. Domenico.
Well, I don't want to interrupt if you're...
Well, I guess just to pursue that just a little bit, I mean, but maybe this is just belaboring it. Granted, there may already be existing methods of protecting the existing priority system. If this is susceptible of an interpretation that it simply means making sure that the priorities are maintained, maybe that's redundant. Maybe it doesn't. And it still could be an interpretation that nothing was meant by it beyond just making sure that those priorities are maintained for the benefit of agricultural uses.
I don't believe so, because the current standard for protection of water priorities is a standard of non-injury. The water court must find that other water rights are not injured by reason of a new development or a change in water rights. Requiring reasonable fulfillment of priorities suggests to me something significantly more than requiring no injury to those priorities.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe you could explain how you view what you view the difference in how this will work under current law than it will work if it's interpreted the way you suggest, just to make it clear to us what the current system means. And then if a local government has a proposal for a new development, what that means in terms of agricultural water rights versus what it would mean if this were to pass.
Okay. There's been a lot of attention lately to the South Platte River Basin and the issues over agricultural water rights that a lot of agricultural water users require or rely on wells, which have generally more junior priorities to more reliable surface water rights that were appropriated prior to 1890. So in many events, agricultural water use priorities that are developed any time within the last 100 years are not fulfilled. Some of the, there's been increasing enforcement of state laws in the last few years, such that some of the well users have had to shut down for not providing adequate replacement water to the stream and have not had the financial ability to come up with those replacement water supplies. So what I believe would happen is the state engineer would provide a letter, Part C1 and 2, commenting on the developer's report, determining whether the proposed water supply is sufficient and sustainable for the development, considering, among other things, the priority of the water rights that are available for the development, then addressing the separate subject of determining if irrigation water priorities for agricultural purposes are reasonably fulfilled. And I don't believe that the state engineer could make a finding that irrigation water priority for agricultural purposes are reasonably fulfilled in an over-appropriated stream basin where there are a lot of irrigation priorities that are out of priority a lot of the time, where lack of senior water rights in some instances means a farmer can't finish off the crop, and particularly the South Platte Basin, where there are wells that have operated for many years that can't operate when the stream is short on water supplies. It would be, I think, very difficult for the state engineer make a finding that irrigation water priorities are reasonably fulfilled in the South Platte River Basin. And requiring such seems to me to mean an admonition from the state engineer to the local government requiring that new development not be approved until this condition somehow changes so that those agricultural water priorities are fulfilled.
Or so either the city would in the future... I mean, a city like Brighton right now can sort of approve new development, and if, as happened recently, that means that the people living there, that in a time of shortage, it's not the people who just moved in who are out of luck in terms of water for their domestic purposes. It's the agricultural uses have to take a backseat in the new development can still use the water. They sort of leapfrog the priority system. And I think as I read, if I interpret it the way you're suggesting, in the future, before, basically the only way the engineer could approve a new development is if he said, if there's a shortage, you have to give up your priority, and you meaning the new development. The local government has to say, well, we'll meet that. We'll allow the agricultural needs to take priority over ours. Is that right? Which flips the current constitutional priority.
Essentially that the local government would be required by the state engineer not to approve the development unless or until the agricultural needs are met. And I think Brighton is a very good example, because Brighton is a town that has operated largely on wells in the same vicinity as some of these agricultural water users, but Brighton has paid the price to go out and acquire the senior reliable water supplies to allow its wells to continue to operate in ways that the agricultural users are not.
Yeah, and I guess Mr. Hobbs's effort was to try to read a conflict out of that section, try to find a way to see if that section can be read reasonably not to conflict with the constitutional priority system, the existing constitutional priority system. And in some ways, the way it's written is kind of circular, right? The engineer has to only determine if the agricultural water priorities are reasonably fulfilled, and of course the agricultural priorities themselves are defined by the constitutional provision that subjects them to being subjugated to domestic purposes. And so in some ways that would be the only way not to find a conflict, I think, is to say that what the engineer would have to do when it's doing, when it's writing this letter from 3C3, is say something like, well, the agricultural priorities are subject to whatever the local domestic needs are, and therefore are subject to, don't take any priority, and so there's nothing to require, at least as to domestic uses. Now, I guess I don't know enough if there are parts of what would go into approving a development, a local government's development, that would still leave some actual purpose to the requiring such, because under that interpretation, requiring such has, he wouldn't ever be requiring anything. And the only thing I can think of is if in a local development approval, there would be approval for certain things that would themselves not take priority over agriculture. For example, I don't know if there'd be some kind of approval of commercial interests that would take water that would be themselves subject to agricultural uses, and I don't know that there's enough there. I mean, I really am troubled by this. I mean, I'm somewhat persuaded that if this in fact does what the petitioners say it does, and it is hard to find it having any other purpose, it does seem to be just the sort of thing where there's a sort of like the public trust doctrine being hidden within a procedural or a change in procedural aspects that is troublesome, and I'm just trying to see if there's a way to read it so there's not that problem.
Well, and let me maybe go to the you know, I indicated there's maybe a second question, but it sort of assumes that if this really does change existing water law priorities, you know, as asserted, then is it a single subject violation? And so my question is, can it be? Is it a separate and distinct purpose? Is this really, now I'm sort of putting aside the specific case, the public rights and water case, because this is awfully close once you get to this point. But just in general principles, I'm wondering if there's an articulation that justifies this on single subject grounds. And I think, Mr. Domenico, you almost, I wish I could remember what you said, you kind of had a good phrase about it, I think. But to the extent that the measure may be trying to make, this is the way you put it, but maybe trying to make sure that new housing developments really can, be based on adequate water supplies without diminishing, threatening water supplies and including agricultural uses, that somehow this, the purpose of the measure is to disfavor new developments unless there really are adequate water supplies, and not to allow buying up agricultural priorities, for example, or things that do flip that upside down. Maybe it's part and parcel of what the proponents are trying to achieve, and they really do mean this in a substantive sense, to flip the priorities. And if so, maybe that's not a separate and distinct purpose. Mr. Lenhart, does that help me through that? I mean, I don't want to just apply public rights and water in a mechanical way just because they're both about water, et cetera. I mean, if this may not be as quite the same case. If this provision is necessary or reasonably necessary for the proponents to achieve their purposes.
The question of adequate water supplies for new development is a question that the state and local governments have grappled with. Many counties and other local governments have their own standards for determining adequacy of a water supply for new development. Both houses of the state legislature now have passed in its amended form House Bill 1141 that sets a statewide requirement for local government findings of adequate water supplies for the new development. But this would completely change the ballgame by not only adopting a somewhat similar set of requirements, but also adding the additional layer on top of that, that unless agricultural water priorities are, basically that as a condition to any approval of new development, agricultural water priorities must be reasonably fulfilled. Now, that is a separate issue from everything else that the issue is trying to achieve by bringing in an implementing procedure that really has is a finding and a mandate on an entirely separate point than the water supplies that are actually available under Colorado's prior appropriation system for the new development.
Well, I guess this is sort of tying into that. Given the other provisions of this, that a local government can approve a development permit that includes that it hasn't determined that there's sufficient water supply, what would C3C3 catch that general provision wouldn't catch? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, if you already have to say, well, we can't give you this permit unless there's sufficient water, isn't C3 saying the same thing?
No, it's not, because it's also imposing the additional requirement that even if there's sufficient water priority system to supply the new development, you also need to require all the agricultural priorities be reasonably fulfilled.
I don't know. I mean, one thing I want to do is maybe I shouldn't be trying to do this, is try to keep separate the procedural mechanisms and the fact that maybe there's a duplication of processes here to protect the priority system versus the substance here. You know, the substance of how this measure may change, water law in Colorado. I mean, to me, and again, maybe I should shift over to this subject, because I don't really see right now any difficulty with the fact that there may already be a system to protect the prior appropriation and existing doctrine and so forth. And maybe this duplicates that. But it seems reasonable that it would, because it's trying to hit that at the point where new developments are seeking housing permits. And if it's a duplicate, if part of this ends up being a duplication, it may be warranted because of the context at which it arises, that it's just simply there's a number of requirements that have to be met, water-related requirements for a new housing development, and if one of them arguably duplicates another process that could arise in a different context, but is it just seems, I don't know, I'm not articulating it very well, but it just seems like it's reasonable for at the housing permit stage, or the, you know, the development, new development process, to even duplicate that protection, if there was no change in the priority system. But even assuming that there is a change for the priority system, it sort of seems to me that it's arguably, now I'm shifting back to the substantive issue here, it seems like maybe it's not a separate and distinct purpose, that it really helps this provision by maintaining or flipping, in a sense, the priorities, helps achieve the purpose of kind of disfavoring development that wastes water. I mean, that's not a very good articulation, but I'm just trying to put on my proponent's hat and figure out how you know, this helps their purposes, this, as opposed to an actual unrelated and surreptitious change in water law that's been thrown in here, you know, buried in you know, deep into the measure. It just seems to me that it could be related to achieving their purposes. But I want some argument about that. But
first, in terms of the question of duplicating the procedure, I believe it's a very major change from the current approach of finding non-injury to existing priorities, which means that they're not able to divert any more or less frequently than they were before the change, versus requiring the reasonable fulfillment of agricultural water priorities, which reasonable fulfillment of priorities is something that just doesn't happen with a lot of agricultural water rights a lot of the time. So that, number one, there's that change. Number two, there's the fact that requiring that there be sufficient water supply available to the locality that's supplying the development is a very different issue than requiring that development be denied whenever there's a non-fulfillment of agricultural water priorities.
You know, I mean, it sounds like I may be suffering in part just because I just don't know much about this area, so I'm not fully digesting the subtleties here. But Mr. Carton,
just a question: Would the C3, would irrigation water priorities for agricultural purposes be an issue for every approval, or would there be circumstances, and I'm thinking about where I live and my experience, the city is part of the Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District. It has water in a reservoir that a ditch drains into. Would there be instances in which agricultural priorities for agricultural purposes wouldn't be an issue? And there, I guess let me phrase it another way. In every circumstance, would a determination have to be made that priorities for agricultural purposes were met? Or are there some cities that get their water and free and clear of any agricultural considerations?
There are some types of water supply that are, under the current water law system, free and clear of concerns about agricultural water priorities, either because they're the most senior priorities in the basin, divert without regard to what anyone else is doing, or because it's a storage water right that's reliably there in the reservoir, or you mentioned the Colorado Big Thompson project by the Northern Conservancy District. If it's a Trans Mountain water supply that's able to bring water from another basin, it's free and clear of the priorities in that basin, but then do you need to consider agricultural water supplies over in the Colorado River Basin, if that's what the local government is relying on? And that's one thing that's certainly not defined at all in the text of this initiative, is what
probably
irrigation priorities would the state engineer need to consider?
And I guess maybe the question probably would be more appropriately posed to the proponents. I'm just wondering if, in every circumstance, that finding where that determination is relevant?
Well, whether it's relevant to the sufficiency of water supplies for the development or not, 3C3 requires that the state engineer make that determination and impose that requirement.
Okay.
Any other questions for Mr. Lenhart? Okay, thank you.
I'd like me to also address our concerns with the title.
Oh, yes, please. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We also believe the title is misleading in its failure to capture this key element of the initiative, the mandate for the state engineer not only to determine that agricultural water rights are fulfilled, but to require that they be fulfilled. It's not hinted at in the title as far as the requirement that they be fulfilled. This also fails to inform the voters. The initiative would reverse the existing constitutional preference for domestic water use, and the title's single subject statement concerning requirement for sufficient water supplies for land use approval also fails to include this component of the initiative. We've also got a concern that the use of the word sustainable with regard to water supply and the use of that word in the title is confusing and may be a catchphrase in the context of current over environment and land use, that it's one of those words that a lot of people use to sound nice to voters without a clear understanding of what it means that contributes to the public. Are there any other questions?
Don't think so. Thank you.
Kemper is also here.
Mr. Kemper, are you representing the proponent?
No, sir.
You're with
World
Water. Okay. Apparently, Mr. Hayes could not be here today, we're maybe just at a disadvantage, but that we don't have the proponent's point of view. Mr. Kemper, if you'd like to come forward, though, and give us your input.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. It's indeed a pleasure to be here today from the title board. My name is Doug Kemper. I'm the Executive Director of the Colorado Water Congress. We are the principal organization in Colorado that represents water interests, agricultural, municipal, industrial, environmental. We've celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. We were created by Attorney General Duke Dunbar and Governor Steve McNichol some 50 years ago to advise them primarily on water policy and define those things that the state could speak on one voice. I am a registered professional engineer in the state, have a bachelor's and master's degrees in environmental water resources engineering, and prior to taking this job, I spent 20 years with the City of Aurora in charge of their municipal water supply planning, operation, and development. Some great questions that all of you had here earlier, and if I might hit on a couple of things, I think early, Mr. Hobbs, particularly this definition of fulfilled versus satisfied. If you look up, and while you were talking, I looked up on the online there and found that the definition of fulfilled in the Webster's Dictionary means to one of them is to measure up to or to satisfy, as you were kind of going down this path of saying, well, is it just that the agricultural water rights priority system, is it the priority system that's being fulfilled and that's being administered in conformance with the law, or is it that these water rights are actually satisfied? And I think many of us in the field would look at that as being that those water rights must be satisfied. And if you follow the definition, that would comport with that. With the definition of fulfill does mean to satisfy, which means that the water rights, which consist of a priority date, a point of diversion on the stream, and a volumetric or a flow rate, that those water rights must be satisfied in order to do that. Now, one of the problems, I think, with this is that it doesn't say which water, agricultural water rights. So, for an example, if you had a development that was in the South Platte Basin, and does that mean that all water, agricultural water rights in the South Platte Basin have to be fulfilled or satisfied? Does it mean all water rights in the state? If you have a municipal water system, for an example, as Aurora's did, where it pulls from both the South Platte, or not just the South Platte, but also the Arkansas and the Colorado River Basin, all of these basins now interconnected, does that mean that all of the water rights in all of those basins must be satisfied as well? And I think that's a practical possibility to do that. It's been a well-known standard in the field that our streams in Colorado are over-appropriated, particularly on the Front Range, which means particularly the South Platte and the Arkansas River basins, which means that there are more priorities than there is physical water to satisfy and fulfill those priorities. That's, we have to have a way of determining who gets water when. That's the fundamentals of the appropriation doctrine. And there's been a lot of talk about the idea of trying to give reduce the dependence on agricultural water rights for municipal water supply. And Mr. Hobbs, I think you picked up on a lot of the dialogue on that. And I've probably purchased more ag rights than probably most anybody in the state. That may be a valid goal, but it's not this initiative, I don't think. When you go through a purchase and acquisition of agricultural water rights, you must go through a process to assure that the stream is left as uninjured, that the existing water rights are protected from those transfers. So this doesn't, simple language of the measure does not give that preference. To say don't go out and buy any more agricultural water rights. It just says that all the agricultural water rights in the basin must be fulfilled, and I think that's perhaps two different things. And currently, you know, the state is currently spending millions of dollars just on the Colorado, looking at the satisfying the needs, and we've been under a process for many years called the Statewide Water Supply Investigation. And looking at what the needs are of the different river basins and so forth, and that's by no means a finished product. If I could, hopping back to the initiative itself, what it requires is that the applicant must demonstrate to the local government that there's a sufficient and sustainable water supply. Now, and part of doing that, he's got to provide a report from a professional engineer. Somehow we've got to have the state engineer make this determination, which he may not be able to do. And if the water supply is supplied by a water supply entity, that entity also must supply that letter. The problem that we have is the very term sufficient and sustainable is not one that we commonly use in the field. If you listen to the record from the review and comment hearings, but if you do, the sponsor said, well, I don't know how to define that necessarily either. It would be up to the legislature or someone else to define that. But since there is no standard definition in the field of what sufficient and sustainable means, it really creates a lot of confusion. If we're talking about, does that mean that there's never a requirement to reduce demand? As many of us have gone through the 2002 drought, we found that we had to have severe demand management measures in place. How frequently those things must happen gets to whether or not there's an adequate water supply. And if you look at, is this a 1 in 10 year occurrence that you're going to have to implement severe demand management? Is it 100? Is it ever? All of these are more social determinations that are properly in front of the water supply entity making that those determinations. Further, as you look at language that talks about that they have to look at the peak day, month, and year, Does peak apply to the day? Does it apply also to month? And does it also apply to year? Does it say? And it's a little confusing to me. We do often use peak day demand to size water treatment plants. But in terms of using looking at the peak month and peak year, It's not the reality of how we do water supply planning in the state. You normally you run a 50-year record, typically comparing supply, demand, and storage levels during that time. And what you do is if you do have storage component in your system, you also look at how low during your design period, how low do your storage levels get drawn. And that is a political determination about what is acceptable. In Aurora's case, that what was prior to the 2002 drought, there was the concept that you could draw the storage down completely empty. From a political standpoint, what Aurora found was that when they got down to 25% full, that was unacceptable. That was politically unacceptable. So you have a difference between not just physically what you can do, but also socially or politically what's acceptable, and that's another determination that has to go into that. And the third one is on economics. And as we're looking now, many water providers strongly ratcheting up their tap fees, their water rates, and in many cases we've seen those in the state double, triple, and more in the last few years. You have to also consider that component as well about what rates are acceptable to the population. Even the word sustainable, if you look that up in the dictionary, you'll see that it's a characteristic of a process that can be maintained at a certain level indefinitely. Well, we have certain cities such as Castle Rock and Parker that are reliant on non-tributary groundwater. This is a non-renewable resource, which means that it is being mined and cannot, by definition, be sustained indefinitely. This is a real substantial change in process. If you look at, and I don't think that the folks are being put on notice of this, if you look at the discussion in here on definition of development permit, means any preliminary or final approval. It's not at the point of planned unit development, but it's for application for rezoning, planned unit development or site plan or similar application for new constructions. That means you're going to have to go through this process each and every time there's a new decision or a modification of that decision. And I don't think folks are being put on notice here of the expense of that process. If you look at a good example is perhaps, and we spent probably more time working on House Bill 1141. We have a State Affairs Committee, has some 150 folks on it that works on legislation during the session. And we've worked on House Bill 1141 as introduced, probably more time on that than we've spent on any bill that we've worked on in my memory. And a lot of it was getting into this definition problem of sufficient, sustainable, adequacy of supply. What does that mean? And if you look at a situation where you have the city, as an example, the city and county of Denver would be, in this case, if you had a development, a 50-unit or more development that was happening in the city and county of Denver, they would be the local government that would be approving that. But the water supply comes from Denver Water, a completely separate entity. So you have this situation of whether, and Denver made this point repeatedly, was whether or not the city and county is, in essence, having control over what Denver Water does. And that was certainly unacceptable to the folks in Denver Water. And the folks there in the city and county of Denver also don't have the staff experience on these things. Further, the state engineer does not have, if you look at the staff to be looking at, they are a regulator, and their job is to make sure that the water rights system is being administered in conformance with our priorities. They do not do planning. That's not generally a function of the state engineer's office. They care about what's happening in the stream today, but what happens in the stream tomorrow is not something. They don't have planners on staff. So if you look at the House Bill 1141, the first fiscal note on that, again, very similar language to this, required the state would have to hire four new FTEs at a cost of $315,000 to do that. So There again, the state does not have the current skill sets to do what's being required, because the state also has to determine if the water supply is sufficient and sustainable. As we've talked about, you've got a lot of different elements here: the economics of the system, the not just the, also the raw water supply, but the ability to deliver and manage that supply, and then also the social considerations that go into that. And the state just does not have that set of skills. And I don't think that the public is being put on notice here that if this initiative passes, that liabilities, new liabilities, are being picked up, because the local government must make a determination that the water supply is sufficient and sustainable. The state government also has to do that. The water supplier, the land developers, you have significant new liabilities that are being passed on as a part of this as part of this process. And I think if you listen to the review and comment hearing, one of the things, the comment the sponsor made was that this initiative was being proposed in case House Bill 1141 did not pass, and in fact it has. And so that concludes my comments again. I don't think that this whole tie to agricultural priorities as defined here in the initiative has any connection to this sufficient, sustainable determination by the local government.
Thank you. Questions? You know, maybe this is a comment, but sort of the picture I'm getting, Mr. Kemper, from your input and from the comments of Mr. Linhart, is that, this is going to be kind of crudely put, and I wish we had the proponent here, but it could be, maybe he can correct this picture. But the big picture I'm getting is that this measure is here, and then there's a carefully developed water rights system in Colorado, intricate, long, a lot of case law, a lot of technical terms of art. There's professional engineers, lawyers, people make their careers out of this. Very intricate. This is the picture I'm getting. I don't understand it. Not my area. That's the picture I've got. And then along comes this measure, which is kind of the bull in the china shop. It doesn't play well with that. It seems to bump up awkwardly against that water rights system, that well-developed water rights system. Now, it may be that it doesn't do that at all. Maybe it fits very well. But I'm sort of getting the picture that, without the benefit of the proponent here to explain how it does play well, that, like, it uses terminology that may or may not be intended to mean the same things to water engineers or water lawyers. I don't know. But it just strikes me that I really don't know whether this, how this affects the existing water law for sure. Frankly, I'm kind of inclined to just accept the arguments and the testimony. It seems pretty persuasive to me, and I don't have the benefit of the proponent to argue against it. I guess I'm sort of explaining where I may be going as far as a vote, but that's kind of what I'm hearing. And I don't imagine you're going to talk me out of that, but
thank you.
I don't know.
You said 1141 did pass?
Yes, sir. It did pass both houses on May 2nd, final house.
Well, so then I really wish we had the proponent here to see if he's going to, if he would just withdraw this, given what you said, that it seems to be duplicative. Now, this does have the one major change that we discussed earlier, and it's a constitutional amendment, and so maybe he'd rather do that. But I can't come up with a way to read the, especially the inclusion of the and requiring such language in a way that doesn't do what Mr. Leonard suggested it does, which is change the priority system, which, while certainly related in a broad sense to concerning a requirement for sufficient water supplies for new land use developments, is just the sort of thing, I mean, just the sort of thing that the court has said is such an additional major change that it really can't be done in the middle of another measure like this. At the same time, I don't know if this is proper. I would be tempted to see if we could lay this over and see, A, if the proponent's going to withdraw it, and B, if not, if we could have the benefit of his perspective on what he really means to do by that section, and if he could assure us that we're misreading that, and then we could all be assured, then maybe that we can move on. That's what I'd prefer to do. If not, I'm tempted to grant the motion for the reasons we've already discussed.
Let me ask Mr. Kneiser. I think there's something. I don't know. I don't want to bump up against. There's something I remember in the initiative statutes about when the board has to complete action, but maybe it doesn't relate to a motion for rehearing. Do you recall whether there'd be any limitation?
Yeah, basically the motion for rehearing generally has to be held within 2 weeks, but I think under particular circumstances the board has discretion to lay it over. There was a case back in the 80s that talked about the fact that a hearing was set for a particular day, and because of circumstances the board had to lay it over to the next day, and the court said that it was within the board's discretion to lay it over to the next day, even though the statute had indicated that it was supposed to be heard on a certain day. I think from what you've described here, given the circumstances, I think the board would have the discretion to lay it over until the next title board meeting if it chose.
I would move that we do that then.
I'll second that. You know, and I appreciate that. I mean, what bothers me about that, if the board adopts that, I mean, the folks here that have spent a lot of time preparing for this meeting and have made very effective arguments are kind of disadvantaged, and I don't know whether Mr. Hayes had an unavoidable problem or did not feel like it. Ms. Gomez, I don't know whether you want to go on the record. Did he indicate why he wasn't able to be here? Okay. But, I want to be respectful of everybody's time, but I think it's pretty important to understand the measure from Mr. Hayes' point of view, from the proponent's point of view. Mr. Lenhardt, do you have any opposition to laying it over?
Yes, we are concerned about that, having been notified that this morning was the date and time for the rehearing. Mr. Hayes was served with our motion for rehearing when it was filed and was well aware of the arguments we made, and certainly has had opportunity to make the board aware of any different meaning that he may have intended, whether he was able to be here personally this morning or not. There was also another proponent to the initiative. He's not here. I've heard no explanation for his actions. But yes, we are concerned about the expense that we've invested in being here this morning for what we anticipated would be a full and final hearing of the motion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I appreciate that, and I guess I'm trying to think, as far as thinking through the motion, if we had Mr. Hayes here and everybody comes back, we may end up having to revisit, for Mr. Hayes' benefit, a fair amount of duplication of testimony, possibly. I just don't know.
Well, I'm not sure we'd have to go out of our way to do anything like that, and I'd probably not want to do it since the laying it over would be essentially for the proponent's benefit, and I don't think we're under any obligation to do it, and I would probably take the same position if I were representing the opponents. At the same time, unless there's a real reason to believe that said, if the board wants to go ahead, I'm going to vote that it doesn't meet the single subject. But I do think it would be a benefit to meeting our obligation to make sure we're making that decision based on a full understanding of the measure, which the courts have said is based not just on a plain reading, but also the that we and the courts in interpreting measures are supposed to take into account the proponent's intention, including their stated intention, and it would be nice now that some of the issues have really been clearly laid out to get that stated intention on the record and see if that resolves the problem. And unless there's a reason to believe it would actually serve to prejudice the opponents other than by requiring them to come back one more time, I'm tempted. I still think it would be a good idea.
And I guess I agree. I think it's a fairly relatively narrow issue as I think it through, that I'm not happy about the additional time that it would require from the people who've already prepared for this hearing. But I agree. I think this is a single subject violation. If I had to vote now, that's what I'd vote. I've tried to defend the measure, put my proponent's hat on, but I can't do it. But it strikes me that maybe it's a fairly narrow question for the proponents. Is what is the effect on the existing water rights system, and maybe secondarily, if it has the effect that the motion for rehearing describes, then how is that not a violation of single subject under the public rights in water case? So maybe it's not. I prefer to err on the side of the right decision, and I guess that's kind of where I am. Mr. Garden.
Mr. Shrimp, can I ask one more quick question? Or Mr. Kemper. And again, it would be good to have the proponent here, but did you participate on 1141? Can I ask you a question real quick? I'm probably replowing ground here, but the measure, subsection 3, it says that the local government shall be, that its determination of the sufficiency shall be based on a consideration of the following evidence. And basically, subsection 1 says the local government has to find a sufficient, sustainable supply. 2 says what the applicant does. Subsection 3 says the determination shall be based on. And just to jump to the end, I want to make sure because it seems to me what everyone has out there now is that if the state engineer in C3 says that there is not, that agricultural purposes are not being reasonably fulfilled, that the local government shall not, cannot approve the proposal. And my question to you is, as far as 1141 goes, is R3, C1, and 2, as far as the letter from the state engineer goes? And my question is, for example, it says in C2 that the letter from the state engineer shall include determining whether the proposed water supply is sufficient and sustainable. During the course of that bill, does everybody understand that provision to mean that if that letter does not say that, that the local government, that on the one hand, the local government can go, fine, thank you very much, but we're going to go ahead and approve the development?
I think there probably would be the ability for the under this initiative for the local government to disagree with the state engineer, and that uncertain, but then you've got this hurdle to accommodate. But the important point on House Bill 1141, that requirement was stricken from the bill.
So there's no letter from the state engineer?
No.
Okay.
No, well, in fact, it's gone through a couple of strike belows. And
there's no 3C at all?
Okay.
Not quite this way.
Factor for consideration by the state engineer is a short, if requested by the local government, the letter from the state engineer.
So 3A and B are still in? 1141? The report from the professional engineer?
3A of the proposed initiative.
Yeah. Is that in 1141?
1141 was stricken below and completely
okay.
Written, so it's
well,
Well, again, and this will be my last question, and I know time is.
I do have a copy of the bill.
That's all right. In your, and I think that probably this is also weighing in on my decision to lay this over to find out, to ask the proponent. But just so I have this to cogitate on between now and if that motion is granted, then the next meeting, is it in your opinion, subsection 3 of the initiative, do each of those, must each of those be fulfilled in order for a local government to approve the application for development?
I would agree.
Or does the local government have discretion to say, we're going to consider it, the language says, consider it, consideration. And where I'm going with that is, and then you don't have a requirement that there be that the agricultural priorities be met.
If you want to answer that, but right, it says that they have to consider that letter, but how that plays with the state engineer requiring those yeah. priorities to be satisfied, I'm not clear on it. Steve, does that agree?
Yeah, and I think I asked about that last
time. I did too.
And which is making me tempted to withdraw my motion, because I'm pretty sure that the response was that it was intended to be mandatory.
And well, and we have it in our title at the very end.
Yeah, and I mean, it does seem to me that it was intended to require that, to basically give the state engineer a veto on that point, that if its determination is that water priorities for agricultural purposes aren't reasonably fulfilled, then he wouldn't give the letter, and or his letter would be, here's my letter, and I require that you do whatever is required to fulfill agricultural priorities. Now, there is the argument that agricultural priorities within it includes the constitutional definition, which is that agricultural priorities are subject to domestic appropriations. But then the mandatory nature of it sort of disappears if you interpret it that way. And so I'm tempted to withdraw my motion and just suggest that we vote this down, because either that section is incomprehensible, what its real effect would be, or if it's got a comprehensible effect that I think was the intent, it was to do what the petition suggests, which is change that constitutional provision, which I think at least two of us are in agreement already that would violate the single subject. And so I withdraw my motion to lay this over, but I may still vote for it
I don't know whether you need the permission of your second, but you have it. So the motion is withdrawn. I think it's fine to grant the motion for a hearing. I mean, I think, the remedy for the proponent is to appeal, and we've set titles, and I assume then the proponent, I'm trying to think this through, the proponent then perhaps would seek reversal and have the Supreme Court affirm the titles, I suppose. And because we have had a fair amount of this discussion that went into the titles, and I'm okay with going ahead and granting the motion for rehearing.
Yeah, and it really doesn't make sense to lay it over hoping that he'll withdraw it when the position we're going to take is to grant the motion anyway. So maybe I'll change my motion to, I move that we grant the motion for rehearing and find that the measure does not meet the single subject requirement, and therefore we don't have jurisdiction to set a title.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 84. The time is 10:50 a.m. Thank you.
next one's going to start at 1, right?
Yes.
No matter what?
Yeah, that's the no matter what.
Good. All right, I'll be back at 1 then.
And if something changes, we'll try to give you a call.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Great. How are you? I'm just going to leave this here.
Sure. I don't worry.
Thank you, Dan. Welcome, Jeff.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to see you.
You've met?
Had a couple of occasions, yes.
Done a little bit.
Okay, let's resume. Well, the next item on our agenda is number 89, which, as I indicated earlier, had been withdrawn. So we'll move on to the next agenda item after that, which is 2007-2008, number 93, Safe Workplace. Again, for the record, now sitting on the title board as the representative of the Attorney General is Jeff Blue, Deputy Attorney General. So let's hear first from the proponents. We'll see if the board has any questions about the measure. Is it Mr. Bellow, I believe? Okay. You'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Michael Bellow, and I'm representing the proponents of the measure.
Are there any questions about the measure for Mr. Bellow? Anything that you think we better know before we before we start talking about this measure?
No, I think this one is pretty straightforward, and I looked at your staff draft, and I don't even have any proposed suggestions or amendments for changing the staff draft.
Just out of curiosity, I don't think this is relevant, but there was a Safe Workplace initiative many years ago. I have not compared the language. Do you have any idea whether the language is similar?
I do not. I have not been able to locate that.
Okay. Well, if there aren't any questions for Mr. Bellow, then let's move on to discussion of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement. And it struck me that it probably did. Any discussion by the board?
I'd agree with that, Mr. Chairman.
And maybe for discussion, I'll go ahead and move that the board find that the measure comprises a single subject and proceed to set titles.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff draft. Ms. Gomez has displayed the staff draft on the screen in the room. Mr. Bellow, you indicated you're okay with the staff draft, I think.
I am. I think it tracks the provisions of the initiative well, and I don't have any proposed revisions to it.
And I don't have anyone else signed up to testify, but if anybody wants to testify on the titles, please let me know. Any discussion by the board? Any suggested changes to the staff draft? I don't have any, so.
I don't have any.
Then I think I'm going to move for the adoption of the staff draft.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 93. And the time is 10:55.
That's not a record, is it?
It's time. Close. I think we've discovered that Mr. Domenico is a real problem for the board. and we welcome Mr. Blue.
Wait till I get my feet wet.
Thank you. I'll be up on the next one.
Okay. Okay, the next agenda item is 2007-2008, number 96, cost of living wage increase. Again, let's first hear from proponents. Mr. Bello. We'll find out if there's any questions, but again, if there's anything that may not be obvious on its face that you want to let us know about, please go ahead and speak up.
Hey. Now, I have a couple of suggested changes in the proposed staff draft language when we get to that point.
Okay. Are there any questions about the measure? Mr. Carton.
Mr. Bell, just kind of briefly, can you kind of explain or encapsulate the difference between the state minimum wage rate provision of the Constitution in Section 15 of Article 18 and what your new Section 82-124 does? What's the difference between?
Yes, sir. The difference is that the minimum wage cost of living increase provision in the Constitution applies only to employees making the minimum wage, which I think $6.85 an hour, whatever it is exactly. I think it went up to, I have a copy of it, went up because of the adjustment in the cost of the CPI just recently. But this initiative deals with essentially employees who are making above the minimum wage, like an employee making $12 an hour or a salaried employee making $30,000 a year. This would apply to those employees and wage paid or salary paid employees, and they would receive an annual cost of living increase equal to the increase as shown by the CPI, the same CPI that's used by the Division of Labor in the minimum wage. So this applies essentially to all the other employees who are not making minimum wage or making above minimum wage.
And I apologize that I haven't looked at the definition of employer and employee in 84101, but does that definition cover both governmental and private employers and employees?
No, it does not. I use the definition, as you see in 84101, that's the what they refer to sometimes as the Wage Claim Act, and that excludes the state or its agencies, counties, cities and counties, essentially government employers, that they are excluded. This applies to private employers with 10 or more employees.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Does this apply to all employees so that no matter how much that employee is making, so if they're making $1 million, they're going to get the increase?
I think theoretically it would.
Why do you say theoretically?
Well, yes, it would.
Okay.
I
just thought
in
that maybe
it would. There's no cap on what the employee would make before that would take him out from under this coverage. So a guy who makes $1 million would get a 2.5% increase if that's what the cost of living was. And of course, the key in this is that if the employee already receives an increase that's equal to or greater, then this doesn't apply. This is just sort of sets a floor.
Any other questions?
And I maybe this question is for the board because you guys probably looked at the minimum wage increase. Is there an inclusion in the minimum wage automatic increase for it does not decrease by the CPI as well?
I did not look at that.
No, it does not have a provision specifying that.
So the minimum wage passed without that. So that, in other words, if we have a recession, the minimum wage will drop.
I don't know if that would be. It's actually. I have the copy of the statute over here.
Mr. Carton has looked at it as well, I think. So, And I'm sorry.
It doesn't provide for a D. It
just says only increase.
I think it's silent on that, Mr. Blue.
Let's see. Minimum wage shall be increased by $6.85 per hour and shall be adjusted annually for inflation as measured by the CPI.
That would go up or down depending on what happens with the CPI. And the reason I ask this question is because I'm wondering if this provision that that there shall not be a decrease turns this into a second subject. And I was hoping to look at the minimum wage one to give me an idea of what had happened in the past, and apparently they didn't address it. So could you address that question?
Well, first, I am not so sure that Section 15 of Article 18 of the Constitution would actually permit the minimum wage rate to be reduced in the event of a decrease in the CPI. I certainly don't think that was the intent of the proponents of that initiative, and it hasn't happened, and we don't know exactly how it might be interpreted in that respect, but I think the fact that it is silent does not imply approval of reducing the minimum wage if the CPI should, in the probably unlikely event that the CPI should actually decrease.
Well, I mean, if you read it, it says shall be adjusted annually for inflation. I mean, I think that that's, I mean, I guess you have to read inflation as strictly only going up, but in the instance where inflation is negative,
well,
that would seem to be a negative adjustment.
I guess we're kind of arguing how to interpret Section 15, but I think the word inflation itself is a word that means an increase in cost of living or in certain parameters of the cost of living. And so deflation, I think, is typically the word, if there is such a real word, I mean, granted, that applies to decreases. So I think that in itself suggests, the use of the word inflation suggests that it could not be decreased because of deflation. So but you know, we're in some respects arguing how to interpret Section 15.
And so that drives me to the next question, though. Could you address the question of whether this is a single whether it violates a single subject by the fact that it won't allow the adjustment when there is deflation?
Well, I think it's a necessary concomitant. In fact, one of the issues that we were asked in the Legislative Council staff hearing was what happens if it goes down. We say, well, our intent is that if the CPI goes down, you don't get a decrease. And the single subject analysis provides that if it's got a necessary relationship, the basic analysis being that it violates a single subject requirement if there's more than one subject and the two distinct and separate purposes are not dependent upon or connected with each other. Clearly, first, we don't think it's two subjects. We think there's one subject here, which is a cost of living increase, and that the mechanism for doing the cost of living increase is the CPI, as the same mechanism that's in the Constitution for minimum wage, and that a necessary concomitant of that is that if that CPI should decrease, that the employers would not be able to reduce the wage or salary that those employees make. So I think under the single subject requirement analysis, first, it's not a separate subject, but even if somebody were to try to term it as a separate subject, it's necessarily related to, has a very direct connection to the overall subject of this initiative, which is to have a cost of living increase subject to the CPI. So it is. I don't think it's a single subject problem. I think that it is, in fact, closely and necessarily related to implementation. Another issue that the courts have dealt with is that implementation of a remedy or enforcement details do not cause something to violate the single subject requirement. For example, it's not violated because an initiative spells out the details related to its implementation, as long as the procedures have a necessary and proper relationship to to the substance of the initiative. That's matter of valid title 1997-98, number 74, 962 P. Second 927, and several other cases have essentially held the same thing, that the implementation or enforcement details directly related to this single subject do not in themselves constitute a separate subject. Another case on point would be in revalid title 2005-06, number 73, 135 P. Third 736. I believe that this is part of the single subject, and that even if you were to look at it as a separate issue, it's an enforcement detail, and it also is necessarily related to the purpose of the initiative.
Well, and I wonder, and I'm really glad Mr. Blue is bringing this up. I had not focused on this, but I wonder that, you know, if there is a conflict, also that you can harmonize them. So let me just ask you about this, Mr. Bello. In other words, if the minimum wage section could be interpreted to allow a decrease in the minimum wage, and this measure were to pass, it strikes me that maybe you can harmonize them by saying that the minimum wage can decrease. This measure prohibits a reduction of current employees. Their wages could not be decreased, but the minimum wage would still go down, and it would affect new employees that are hired. They could be hired at a lower rate. Is that fair?
I think that is a fair harmonization of them. We're really, as we say, we're not really directly concerned with the minimum wage rate here, and should it be interpreted, if it should happen, that there would be deflation, and that if it were interpreted that Section 15, the state minimum wage rate, could be reduced, that would not affect the employees that this measure affects, which are probably 95%, depending, well, I have to say this applies to employers of 10 or more employees, so I don't know what the percentages actually are. It's far less than 95%, but the last statistics I saw just overall were that the minimum wage affects less than 10% of the employees in Colorado. This wouldn't necessarily affect the other 90 because of the 10-employer requirement, the 10-employee requirement. Trying to, we don't want to affect small employers. I think that's a way of harmonizing. I think that they are really, though the mechanisms are kind of similar in some respects, they are really serve two different purposes. That is the minimum wage rate increase and this cost of living increase for other employees not affected by the minimum wage rate.
Let me follow up on what you've just said. I think that that raises a question. Your answer raises a question for me, in that, are you envisioning this as setting up classes of employees so that that class of employees' base salary goes up, or is the company still allowed to hire new employees in at whatever salary they want for that class? So, for instance, if you have laborers on a construction site, and the wage that this company brings them in at is $10 an hour, and each year it goes up based on this for each year they work there, and then they bring somebody else in, that person can still be brought in at 10, but yeah. Then, you know, so on the third year their base salary is still $10 and not 10, 30 or whatever it would be with this increase, right?
Yeah, this doesn't interfere with the employer's ability to hire people at the wages at which it selects for that position, whether it be $10 an hour or a minimum wage or above. Anything, of course, they have to comply with the minimum wage. This does not affect new employees. That's the employer's traditional right to hire employees at the salary that it can negotiate with them, essentially, because it's kind of looked at as an agreement, in a sense, where the employee and the employer say, all right, I'll work for you for $10 an hour, or I'll work for you for $11 an hour. This does not affect that. This deals with current employees and wage increase requirements thereafter.
And is there anything in the current statutes to prevent a company from firing somebody so they don't have to go through this process and just hire new people in?
Well, there's nothing in our proposal that deals.
Well, I know, but I mean, just current law. I'm not an employment lawyer. I'm just asking the question.
For example, to fire an employee rather than paying the state minimum wage rate. I mean, that's
no.
The only statute.
No, from doing this increase, the CPI increase, you fire your laborers and you bring in new guys in at $10 an hour, so you don't have to go through the.
Well, I don't think there's anything in current law that would prohibit that. I mean, I suppose as an employment lawyer, I could probably think of some theories that would be, but there isn't any particular statute. There's no statutory mechanism that would prohibit that.
Right. Any other questions about the proposal? We've been talking already about single subject, but I do have one other person signed up who might want to talk about single subject, so let's give Mr. Friednash an opportunity. If you'd like to come forward, Mr. Friednash, and identify yourself for the record and who you represent, if anyone. And I think we're the subject is single subject.
Good morning. Doug Friednash. I'm with the firm Fairfield and Woods, and I'm representing Joseph Blake. If I could approach, here's the, I happen to have a copy of it, 4101, that's got the definitions, just in case you're around.
Thank you.
First of all, I think it is impossible to set a title on this. This is fatally flawed at its inception, and it can't be fixed. And the reason goes to the heart of the inflationary factor used here. This measure uses it says an employer shall provide their employees an annual wage or salary increase to account for an increase in the cost of living as measured by the consumer price index used for Colorado. If I can approach, I'm going to hand you. This is a frequently asked questions that was prepared by the U.S. Department of Labor. Let me start with this basic proposition. And the basic proposition, and I've got a letter that even the department says, but it'll be obvious in a minute. There is no such thing as consumer price index used for Colorado. There just is no such thing. If you look at statutes, and you look at the Constitution, you may find 56 references to consumer price indexes. There is no such thing. There's a consumer price index used for Denver, Boulder, Greeley, and there is a consumer price index, a regional one, a Western regional one. And what I want to call your attention to are just a couple quick points that are highlighted by this frequently asked question document. And it says the consumer price index is a measure of the average change over time and the prices paid by urban consumers for market-based of consumer goods and services. And it's used for, the major factors are for an economic indicator, as a deflator of other economic series, and as a means of adjusting dollar values. If you look on page, question 16, it talks about this document, which I think is extremely well written, defines, I mean, there's different kinds of metropolitan indexes, and then there's regional ones. And in particular, it says what area indexes are published and how often. In the middle, it says the BLS also publishes index for 27 local areas. These indexes are byproducts of the national CPI program. Each local index has a much smaller sample size than the national or regional indexes, and is therefore subject to substantially more sampling and other measurement error. As a result, local area indexes are more volatile than the national or regional indexes. And BLS strongly urges users to consider adopting the national or regional CPI index for use in escalator clauses. If you go to page 10 of 15, question 20, it discusses the limitations of the CPI. There it says the CPI may not be applicable to all population groups. For example, the CPIU is designed to measure the experience with price change of the U.S. urban population and thus may not accurately reflect the experience of people living in rural areas. Also, the CPI does not produce official estimates for the rate of inflation experienced by subgroups of the population, such as elderly or the poor. Now,
I'm sorry, Mr. Friedrich, where were you reading?
That's question 20 on
question 20.
Page 10 of 15.
Thank you.
Here's the problem. There are all kinds of economists who've talked about these different indexes and how even within Denver, Boulder, Greeley's economist, Stephen Weiler, who has been published in several articles, and I can get copies of those. But basically the proposition is, even within these areas, they're not accurate. So how do we tell the voters we're using a consumer price index used for Colorado when there is none? You can't. It's misleading. It goes to the heart of what 140.106.5 was designed to prevent. And you can't do it. There is no such thing.
Excuse me for interrupting, but that's the same phrase that's used in Article 18, Section 15 for the minimum wage. I'm assuming that works. I understand that the language might be improved upon. I mean, ahead.
Let me get to that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's a great question. No, I'm happy you brought it up. It was used. It shouldn't have been used. It wasn't challenged. It should have been challenged. And what the department has done is precisely use the Denver Boulder Greeley, which my understanding will be challenged in court. I don't think that is a done issue. But having said that, at this point, we're focused on this one. And what I would tell you is that is the core of the problem. They used in the Constitution, as you know, I'll find the sites, but there's six constitutional references to the CPI indexes. And that's the problem. In that one, they didn't say use Denver Boulder Greeley. The fact that they did doesn't cure the problem. And I point out these things to show that when you're telling the voters we're going to use the consumer price index used for Colorado, and even by the Department of Bureau of Labor Standards says there's no such thing, and you try to figure out what we're telling the voters about what we're using, the volatility of the Denver Boulder Greeley in and of itself is not reflective of the state of Colorado. It's not. And it's a problem that can't be fixed. It was a problem raised by legislative council, and they resubmitted it. You'll see another initiative, and it hasn't been fixed. Should have been fixed. It hasn't been fixed. It can't be fixed. You can't set a title on something that is fundamentally flawed. And I realize, you know, I wasn't around when Amendment 42 came into play. I wasn't involved. I didn't challenge it. I wish I would have. Wish I would have been here. But I'm here today. I'm here today saying you can't do it. Drilling down, and I pointed out, I realize you don't get to the merits, but these are things that you need to understand the perspective of apprising the voters. And I think it's essential. There are other problems. I don't think it's clear on how this works with Amendment 42 and Article 15. I think it raises a lot of questions. It talks about being a cost of living wage increase or salary increase. I'm not sure how that works for ultimately works with minimum wage employees. And I don't have the answer today, but I think Mr. Blue raised a good question with respect to that. And I'm not sure how it would be harmonized. It also, though, prohibits employees from contracting. It also creates an administrative procedure that's new and separate, and a civil procedure that's new and separate. So I think, taking its totalities, it's flawed because of the single subject problems and because you cannot possibly apprise the voters of what you're doing here when you are potentially using the same index used before, which is not the one used for Colorado. There are different ones. And I think it needs to be clear and succinct, and it's not. And the title can't fix it.
Aren't you partly just, I mean, even if the measure had been clear and it said Denver Boulder CPIU or something like that, you're just criticizing, you'd criticize that choice as a bad index.
No, I'd say you're telling the voters what you're doing.
Oh, that you're saying it is okay.
You can use it. The problem is you asked me about Amendment 42 and the other measure. They have used a different one, and the voters weren't aware of what they were doing. And to say we're going to use a consumer price index used for Colorado is a problem you can't fix because there is no such thing. That's the problem. If they use Denver Boulder Greeley, fine. You know, there's all kinds of statutes that say Denver Boulder Greeley. There's constitutional amendments that identify Denver Boulder Greeley. That is not what they did here.
Let me follow up here. And in interest of full disclosure, I probably should have said this at the outset of this, is that I was working at Fairfield and Wood through the end of December. So I worked with Mr. Friednesh for several years leading up to this year. Ms. Friednesh, you actually, when you talked about these frequently asked questions, you discussed the fact that the local CPIs have higher margins of error, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, I thought you were going to go down the path of saying that they shouldn't be used, but I'm now hearing you saying that if that was what the text of the initiative was, that you would be okay with that. So could you clarify, please?
Yeah, I would. My point is, they are the Denver Boulder Greeley one is not reflective of the state of Colorado. Number one, number two, it's volatile, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics says, hey, you know, we recommend, strongly recommend, that's the word, use a different one. I can't change which, how they decide to write these texts. But what I can tell you is, if they had said, we will use Denver Boulder Greeley, that would have fairly apprised the voters of what they were voting on. This is the standard. There are great disparities between a regional standard, which is clearer and more reasonable and responsive to these factors, than Denver Boulder Greeley. And I think the problem is they didn't identify it, and the department can't just go choose one, because ultimately the voters are not being apprised of what this is doing. And you know, we're trying to prevent surprise and or fraud being practiced on the voters, and you can't do it the way this is written. You cannot fix that problem. I wish they would have chose one.
Well, what would you say about the argument that, well, the because the state of Colorado was already using Denver Boulder Greeley for the minimum wage, that they are aware of what the department's going to do, and so there really isn't a surprise because they know what the department's going to do?
We don't know what the department will do, number one. Number two, the department could say, you know, groups can meet with them and talk to Mike McArdle and say, Mike, we recommend you use the regional one. What happens if they use a regional one, by the way, for this, and then Denver Boulder Greeley for Amendment 42 or the minimum wage increase? You've got these inherent problems that can't be fixed, and we don't know what the department's going to do. We have no idea. So it's not that easy. And what we haven't done is told the voters what we're doing. And there are problems. And, you know, you read articles in Fort Collins newspapers particularly about the problems created by the other measure and how it's impacting areas within those areas. So I think that the voters are entitled to know which index is going to be used. You know, if the index, the local indexes are not reflective of rural areas, that's a problem.
You know, one thing I didn't understand, maybe I missed this. Under the minimum wage provision in the Constitution, it looks like there should have been an adjustment January 1, 2008 based on the CPI. Are you saying that did not happen, that they don't use one?
January 1, 2008, shortly thereafter, they made an adjustment and they had determined to use the Denver Boulder Greeley index.
Oh, okay. And I think Mr. Blue is raising the question, okay, they actually used one, right or wrong. They made an interpretation of what the Constitution meant by consumer price index. They used an index, right or wrong. And now this measure comes along and says, use that one. And doesn't that specify that it's going to be the Denver Boulder Greeley?
It doesn't, because it doesn't say Denver Boulder Greeley.
Well, it says, but it has to be the one that they use in setting the minimum wage.
I disagree with that.
They can
use any one they want. They can use the regional one. They can decide to use a regional one. They could say, you know, look, we've had more problems. I think you have to say which one you're going to use. And the problem is, like I said before, you know, I think it will be challenged. I can't predict what will happen. But if you wanted to use the Denver Boulder Greeley, why didn't you just say it? I mean, why are we not being clear with voters in terms of which one we're going to use? And there are big differences between those things. And you know what? You have new administrations. You have people being turned over. Who's to say in the future which ones will be used and why? I mean, there was a fundamental problem with Amendment 42. It wasn't addressed, and there's a fundamental problem with this one.
Proponents did not want to specify. Maybe what was more important to them, knowing that the minimum wage provision is unclear, that the index might change. It's still going to have to be a CPI index. I think that's pretty clear. But the particular index that's utilized may change. But maybe the proponents just simply wanted it to be the same. Wouldn't that be the right of the proponents to say that we want these to be in sync, even if there is a change in the index that's used for minimum wage?
Well, I can't predict or understand why they use this one. I'm not sure why they didn't provide clarity. Legislative Council asked specifically about it. It was an issue that came up. It was an issue raised, and it was not an issue that was addressed. I don't know why they did the way they did it, but it is unclear. It's vague. And, you know, they can use different factors. Ultimately, when there's this kind of ambiguity, the department can do whatever they choose to do. But the problem is, again, as pointed out by the name of the person, I thought I had the memo, but you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is written. They have no such CPI, and that's the problem. I think the fact that the department has to implement something doesn't cure the fundamental problem, which is the voters are voting on this initiative, and they're voting on a CPI index thinking there's one for Colorado when there isn't one for Colorado.
Mr. Carton.
Mr. Friedenetz, just since we're in the single subject phase here, to just bring it back, can you tell me, and I understand that you have an issue with the terminology here, consumer price index, and what that may or may not be, and how that, if the measure were to pass, would be determined. But what exactly, how is that, and you said fatally flawed, I think, how does that go to single subject? Are you arguing that the measure can't be understood well enough for the board to set a title? Are you arguing that somehow the failure to specify, the narrow down on a CPI, amounts to multiple subjects or surreptitious purposes? Or could you maybe, if you wouldn't mind,
You bet. That's a good question. I think it's the first and the third. I think it's surreptitious. I don't think you can set title on it because there is no title. And in terms of the concept of single subject, it's the four or five I laid out earlier, which is you got a measure that talks about a wage increase. You've got a measure that prohibits employers from contract because employers can't reduce the wages or salaries of employees because of a decrease in the CPI. It precludes them from entering into contracts. You have a new administrative procedure. You have a new civil remedy procedure. And you have a single subject problem with the interplay of this and Amendment 42 or Article 15 of the Constitution. Those are the problems, and there's several of them.
Mr. Carton.
Thank you for that. And so I guess my comment is that to the extent, I think that the measure, I appreciate, as always, your persuasive arguments and points and issues that you raise, but I think that there is a single subject. I think that to the extent that there may be an ambiguity with the term consumer price index, CPI, used for Colorado, we have numerous instances in the Constitution, as Mr. Friedenetz has pointed out, and in statute that uses that terminology. And so to the extent that that particular term may be somewhat ambiguous, I don't think that is fatal to a single subject determination for the measure. And I feel as though the other various points that the measure goes to are still within the purview of the annual cost of living increase in employee wages, as it's stated in the draft. So, you know, I know that we've got provisions where it talks about consumer price index used for Colorado, and I think one of your comments was that the Department of Labor couldn't fix that, couldn't set that. But I'm not so sure that's right. I think that probably they can, and I think probably they have. And I think it may involve rulemaking. It may involve bringing together the interested parties in some kind of a public forum. But that's what kind of my take on it. But I appreciate you pointing that out.
Let me just provide a little clarity on that, too. Of the 56 references, don't hold me exactly this, but I'm pretty sure that the only one that is vague is Amendment 42. The others specifically say Denver, Boulder, Greeley, National Price Index, Denver, Boulder. There's only two that don't, as far as I'm pretty sure that's correct. And I've got references, and I'll double-check them, but I read through it this morning. So I think it is a problem. This then say we're going to use some index which doesn't exist. How can we, and I understand your position, how can we put, and again, I wasn't here to challenge it. My understanding is that issue wasn't raised or picked up on by legislative council before, but they picked up on it this time. And I think it's significant. And when we're trying to adjust the index for Coloradans, there is a big difference between which index you use and which index is more reliable. And I think it's surreptitious.
Any more discussion about single subject? Thank you. Mr. Bellow, if you'd like to respond.
Members of the board, I think most of Mr. Friednash's comments go to the merits of this measure as to, for example, the merits of whether we should use the CPI for the Denver Boulder Greeley or we should use the national CPI. I mean, those are beyond the purview of this title-setting board. It was our intention. I mean, first of all, it says used for Colorado. It doesn't say, it's not misleading. It says the one that's used for Colorado, it directly tracks the language of or Article 18, Section 15, for a reason, partly because part of the enforcement responsibilities under this would be through the Division of Labor. It would be incongruous for us to be saying, well, you should use another CPI for the determination of the minimum wage, but you should use this, you know, the national CPI, or a different specified CPI, for purposes of determining the cost of living increase. We wanted it to be consistent with that. They haven't had any problems in determining which CPI to use. I only have one copy of this, but this is their Department of Labor's minimum wage back sheet where they did make the adjustment. And the adjustment is in the... view is that they selected, they had no problem with any ambiguity in Amendment 42, as it was Section 15 of Article 18 of the Constitution. It's our intent to be consistent with that. If for in the future the Bureau of Labor Statistics were to develop a CPI that covered the whole state of Colorado, perhaps that was different from this, and if the Department of Labor, Division of Labor, were to change and use that whole Colorado measure, then under this, they would be, if they use that under the minimum wage, they'd be able to use the same one under this. That determination is left to the Department of Labor, but they obviously figure that the best CPI we've got for Colorado, the only one that applies to Colorado, is the Denver Boulder Greeley, which probably covers 85% of the population of Colorado in any event. So we don't. This is not surreptitious. This, in response to the question that the legislative council staff asked, which was which CPI should you use, we responded by saying you should use the same CPI that the Division of Labor uses for the minimum wage adjustments. So we think that it's not a problem with a single subject, and it's not surreptitious. In fact, it was specifically to try to give guidance to the Division of Labor in using the same CPI they use for that amendment. So those are essentially my comments, that most of his concerns about the CPI not being accurate are issues that subject to argument to the voters, subject to persuasion, but they don't have anything to do with whether it's a single subject problem or whether that's surreptitious. This was in fact designed to give guidance to the voters and to the Division of Labor in order to use the same CPI and be consistent with the same agency, which will have some enforcement responsibilities under this proposed initiative.
Any questions for Mr. Bellow? Thank you. Mr. Friednash, brief response.
Brief response, thank you. You're entitled to drill down to understand whether something complies with the statutory standard, constitutional standard, number one. It's not the only one used in Colorado. See, that's the problem. There's a West, there's a regional one for the West that is also used, and that's what that shows. And it wasn't an easy decision for the department. They sought input, as I understand it, and had a difficult time trying to figure out what they were supposed to use. They had to do something, so clearly they were going to implement something. And the Denver Boulder Greeley is not applicable to 85% of this population. And even if it were, that's not Colorado. So,
actually, Mr. Freenish, can I ask you a quick question? Because I think that this goes right to that issue. Subsection 1, it says, the CPA shall be the same index used by the Department of Labor and Employment in making adjustments for inflation to the state minimum wage rate pursuant to Article 18, Section 15 of the Constitution. Seems to me that we don't have a possibility of the department using two different CPIs, because this is telling them to use the same one for Amendment 42 and for this one. And so that was one of your arguments, and I just wanted to have you respond to that.
Well, I'm not clear on that, actually. It says that they use the same one that they would use in Article, was it Article 18?
Yeah, it's the minimum wage.
Section 15 just says use the one for Colorado, so it doesn't really say. And I think the department could theoretically design two different indexes under this initiative, or just in general, because there's no clarity in what to use. I think you could have two different administrations changing them at different times based on the time within which they adjust them. I know the regional ones are, I think, annually. The local ones are semi-annually. So I'm not real clear on that.
Okay, let's go ahead and address the single subject question. Any further discussion by the board, or is there a motion?
I'd move, Mr. Chairman, board find that proposed initiative 2007-2008 number 96 contains a single subject title for the measure.
I'll second that. And again, I as we said, I think this is, you know, I think the proponents could make other drafting choices, but it sounds actually like this is a pretty precise choice that they wanted this, the same index to be used, and it seemed like that's what they said, and I don't see a single subject issue out of that.
I'd have to agree. I think that the concern about the consumer price index and which one is the state of Colorado's consumer price index is legitimate. And, you know, I hesitantly agree that it's a single subject, and I think it's only saved because of the sentence that says that it shall be the same one as used from Amendment 42. And even then, I'm not 100% comfortable with it, but I think at this point my vote would be that it is a single subject.
Okay. That's been moved and seconded. If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff drafts. Ms. Gomez has displayed the staff draft on the screen in the room. Mr. Bella, you said you did have some issues with the staff draft, I believe.
Minor issues, Mr. Hobbs and other board members. This is designed to require an increase for the cost of living and wages or salaries. There are many employees who are salaried, and sometimes there's a distinction made that wages are hourly paid employees. And so I think that in the, at least not necessarily in every iteration of the word wages here in the draft, I think at least initially in the line 2 and perhaps in line 3, it should say, for example, increases in employees' wages or salaries in line 2. And in line 3, provide annual wage or salary increases. I don't think that we need to necessarily repeat that every time the word wage is used, but I think it would be clearer because we do intend to affect salaries of so-called white-collar workers as well as wages. That would be the primary change that in those first, in the second and third line. I think after that, maybe the reiteration of the wage or salary is really sort of unnecessary given the clarification in the first two lines. or second and third line.
Okay. You know, and I might just comment. I mean, I think that change strikes me as okay. A mechanical guideline that we follow is sort of avoid a conjunction in the expression of the single subject, which is in this staff draft is what follows immediately after the word concerning annual cost of living increases in employee wages. That's the expression of single subject, and we're required to express a single subject. Whenever you say put in an and or an or, sometimes it's a danger sign that it's more than one subject. But I don't see wages and salaries as being different things. It's one of those situations where they're essentially the same concept. And so, if it were increases in wages and something else that's totally unrelated, that might be a problem. But to me, that strikes me as being okay. I didn't appreciate maybe that there is as much of a distinction as you indicated. But
as an employment lawyer, Mr. Hobbs, I think there are times, not always, there are times when some people will infer from the word wage that it could refer to an hourly wage as opposed to a salary, like a weekly or biweekly paid employee. And that's why when we drafted this, we were precise in mm-hmm. in the first, the second lineup to say wage or salary increase. I think that at least once, maybe not in that initial line two, but at least perhaps in line three, it should say wage or salary increase. Just, there might be some person, a voter, who could look at this and say, well, does this apply to me? I'm a salaried employee. I don't get work for wages. So I just think it would make it a little bit clearer at least to have at least one statement of wage or salary, probably in line three. And if you thought it might do some harm to the single subject requirement or the statement of the single subject in line two.
Just to make a comment, I think that it doesn't destroy the single subject because I think that wages and salaries are the subset of employment income, for lack of a better word. And so but I think it is important because I think you will have that confusion in the voters of who's a salaried employee, does this apply to me, mm-hmm. and the text of the initiative itself says wages and salaries.
Mm-hmm. If there were a term that a single term that embraced both of those, I might prefer that in line two. But I, for example, employee compensation. But frankly, I don't. That's maybe too broad. I mean, I think this is pretty specific to wages and salaries.
Right. Right. And compensation. Correct. That could include bonuses, for example. That could include other remuneration. And also, I'm trying to state this in simple. I'm not dumbing down anything, but I mean, in simple terms that people understand, wages or salaries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other issues with the staff draft?
No, not really. On line 14, I thought that it says receive the required cost of living wage increase, that it could be stricken, the word wage could be stricken there, because prior to that it talks about cost of living increase, and it seems unnecessary to say cost of living wage increase in line 14 mm-hmm. when the previous three lines just call it a cost of living increase. Just a little stylistic.
Okay.
And I'd actually agree with that one.
Yeah.
And I think actually to follow up on the changes, I think we need to do it in the ballot. Say we need to track those changes in the ballot title submission clause.
Yes, and we would do that. So, and sometimes we just tend to focus on the, like the first 15 lines, and usually try to remember at the end that any change to say for the record any changes that we made in the title would also be made in the ballot title and submission clause because they do need to match.
Correct. So, okay. Yes, that was my intent too.
Yeah. Okay. Let me find out if Mr. Friednesch has any issues with the staff drafts. And then we'll come back and see what changes the board wants to make. Mr.
My only comment is just to reiterate whatever he said. Again, I don't think you can set title to this because there's no consumer price index used for Colorado. And I did find the letter or the email which says the Bureau of Labor Statistics does not publish consumer price index data at the state level. Therefore, we do not have an index specifically for Colorado. Colorado is defined as part of the West Census region for which we publish data on a monthly basis. Within Colorado, we publish a metropolitan area index for the Denver-Boulder Greeley metropolitan area on a semiannual basis. I think the title has to reflect that we're going to set it based on the CPI index used for Colorado. So voters can be aware of the fact that that's the specific language used in the text, and they can then drill down and realize that there is no such thing. I think that's the only fair way to apprise the voters of what this does.
But if we, instead of, I don't know, if your suggestion goes toward, if this is a suggestion, if it goes towards maybe revising, I don't know, lines 5 and 6, and saying requiring that such increases be measured by the CPI for Colorado, and then maybe saying what? I mean, you wouldn't want us to say, and we don't know what that is.
Like I said, I don't think you can set it, but I think it should reflect the language. It says, I mean, the very first sentence of what this does is the CPI used for Colorado.
But if
and
we
that's the same language that we used in Amendment 42 and in Article 28, Section 15. And I understand you can then use the next sentence. I mean, it's up to you how you decide it, but I think the voters really need to understand what this does or doesn't do. I mean, that goes to the heart of the problem. I don't think you can set it. But if you're going to, I think you almost have to put in the problematic language.
So I think what you're trying to say is that that where you go to CPI, you'd say the CPI of Colorado on line 5 right before requiring that such increases be measured by the consumer price index for the state of Colorado and shall use the same index by the Department of Labor?
I just, my only point is I think it should say the consumer price index used for Colorado. What else you do with it? So that is the language and that is the problem. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bello, if you want to comment briefly.
I think we're retreading the same ground that we just retreaded before the single subject. I don't think it's necessary to say used for Colorado. I mean, the purpose of that was to really key it exactly to the same provision being used. And if that provision should change, this gives the flexibility to the Division of Labor. If there is a better one that comes along, according to Mr. Friednesh, and the Department of Labor were to use that because it was for the whole state of Colorado, this would enable the flexibility to do so. We did not want to freeze into a statute a particular CPI for Greeley Boulder when under the constitutional provision, that determination is essentially left to the Division of Labor. And the best one they've got is the one they're using now. Trust the Division of Labor will continue using the best one that we've got.
Okay, thank you.
I don't think it's necessary to change. I'm sorry for interrupting, Mr. Hawes. I don't think it's necessary to change that. It spells it out quite clearly. Shall be measured by the same consumer price index used by the State Department of Labor and Employment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carton.
Yeah, and I think that is an accurate statement there on lines 5. Through 7, you know, you could, one way to do it would be, I suppose, to, and I think that there's suggestions here, say requiring that such increases shall be measured by the same consumer price index for Colorado used by the State Department of Labor. But I think what it says now, requiring that such increases shall be measured by the same consumer price index used by the State Department of Labor and Employment to make changes to the state minimum wage, is accurate given the text of the measure. Whether or not, as Mr. Friednesh has posited, the measure should further specify that it's the consumer price index used for Colorado, I guess I would defer to the board on that. I think there's ways to elegantly make that change, but I'm not sure it's completely necessary either. That's one suggestion would be requiring such increases shall be measured by the same consumer price index for Colorado or shall be measured by the, instead of same, Colorado consumer price index used by the State Department of Labor.
I think you could easily say that it shall be measured by the. I'm sorry. It requiring that such increases shall be measured by the consumer price index used for Colorado, and shall be the same
as the consumer price index used by the State Department of Labor to make the changes to state minimum wage. I think it certainly is more accurate description of what this does to do that. Put that in there. Does it change what we're doing at the end of the day? Probably not. Certainly it's more accurate.
And say that again, Mr. Blue. What would the change be?
I was thinking, because I can't look at my paper one because that one has different line numbers for me.
Oh.
Somehow mine printed out differently. Increases shall be, let me see where we are again. On page, on line five, increases shall be measured by the consumer price index used, same language, used for Colorado, which shall be the same consumer price index used by the State Department, et cetera, et cetera. I think that gets us to where we want to be if we want to actually language of the initiative.
Well, I guess I'm, and I might be missing something, but I don't see that it's more accurate to do it that way, and it does seem that it's more cumbersome, but I might be missing why that's more accurate. I mean it seems like the staff draft as it is combines two different provisions. I mean, it first says it's measured by the consumer price index used for Colorado, and then it says that CPI shall be the same one used as the Department of Labor and Employment. But it seems like all this does is just to compress the staff draft, just compresses that into, you know, instead of saying shall be A and A will equal B, we just say shall be B, you know.
Right. Well, I see what you're saying, and my concern only is that when the voters go to vote on this, assuming this makes the ballot, they're going to be, a lot of people are going to look at that and say, what is the State Department using to make changes to the state minimum wage? They won't know. And by saying the one used for Colorado, they get the idea that this is the CPI for Colorado, not the one for the nation, not the one for New York City, but the one that's out here. There's nothing in this title that says anything related to Colorado.
Could I make a suggestion? I think it might address Mr. Blue's concerns, and without perhaps adding too much to the length of this, and I'm concerned in part because I know the voters are going to probably have a large number of ballot initiatives, but I think maybe we could address Mr. Blue's concerns with just the phrase, inserting the phrase for Colorado in by the same consumer price index used for Colorado by the State Department of Labor and Employment. Just insert those two words, for Colorado. Then just continue with by the State Department of Labor and Employment to make changes. I think that captures, that says Colorado, and that doesn't have such as much quite, you know.
I think that actually, that's certainly more elegant than my suggestion by a long shot.
So, and we don't have any problem with that. So
the way Ms. Gomez has it on the screen now, is that correct? Measured by the same consumer price index used for Colorado by the State Department of Labor and Employment to make changes in the state minimum wage.
And I think that gets to what I was trying to get to, which is I think it needs to reference CPI for Colorado, even though Mr. Friednesch has clearly demonstrated that there really isn't one for Colorado.
Okay. I'll go ahead. I don't know. I think are we in the amendment phase here? I'll go ahead and just move that change then, as shown on the screen.
I'll second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. So while we're at it, then let's just keep going. Did you have others, Mr.?
Oh, I was going to ask you about adding the word salary. I thought we had a discussion about that.
I guess I wanted to propose just doing line three. I mean, I don't feel strongly about line two, so I can be persuaded otherwise. But if we just said, as Mr. Bellow suggested in line three, just say annual wage or salary increases, if that's sufficient, well, and there may be some other changes here, but if that's sufficient without making that change?
Salary, singular, right?
Yeah. If that's sufficient for the first three lines, that would be my preference. Again, and Mr. Blue, you may prefer to put that in line two as well.
Yes, I would too.
You would prefer?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll just make that part of what's going to be my motion, I think. Let's say employees' wages or salaries in line two. I don't know what's wages or and or wages
that
or.
Should be plural.
Wages or salaries in line two. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That one needs to be plural.
Then I would suggest, Mr. Hobbs and board members, that in line eight, where it says that specifying that the cost of living increase shall not apply for employees who receive annual wage increases equal to, I think it probably should be inserted there for clarity, wage or salary increases in line eight.
I agree. That needs to go in there as well.
Okay.
And I guess it needs to go in nine. Wages. Reducing wages or salaries.
Then I think, Mr. Hobbs and members, that if we were to delete in line 14 the word wage increase, then the rest of it uses the phraseology of cost of living increase, so it doesn't present the same issue.
And I agree. I'll make that motion, the changes that are shown on the screen.
Second it.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Other changes to the staff draft?
None from the proponents.
I'd like to move a change in line. I have the same problem, so let me line it up here. Line four, after the word living, change the comma to a semicolon. No object? You do object? Oh, okay.
Objection.
Maybe if there's no objection, we'll do a formal motion. That's just for consistency. Any other suggested changes? If not, then is there a motion to adopt the staff draft as amended with the understanding that the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause?
So moved.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. There's no other discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0, and that completes action on number 96. The time is 11:57 a.m., and we will be in recess until 1 p.m. Thank you.